morning, everybody. How are you doing? Are you having the most amazing TCAF ever? You know that's a rule, right? Every year is the most amazing ever. That is actually a rule of TCAF. Also, everyone is queer at TCAF. Right?
It's been my experience.
And mine too. People who are formerly completely straight show up at TCAF and suddenly are completely queer. Before we start, I have a few announcements. So please share. The Toronto Comic Arts Festival would like to acknowledge that the land on which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, and the Haudenosaunee and the Huron-Wendat, and that Indigenous peoples have lived on and cared for this land for more than 15,000 years. This territory is covered by the Dish With One Spoon Wampum Belt Treaty. Today, Toronto is still home to the many Indigenous peoples from across Turtle Island. We acknowledge that settlers on this land directly benefit from the process of colonization. In recognition of our gathering on these lands for TCAF 2019, the festival has made a donation to the Gord, Downey, and Cheney Wenjack Fund. We look forward to increasing our support and programs for Indigenous creators in the years to come. I'd also like to point out that there's a table on the first floor of Indigenous Creator Comics, which you all really must take a look at. They didn't tell me to do that. I'm telling you to do that. Programming at TCAF 2019 is sponsored by Seneca College's Faculty of Communication, Art, and Design. TCAF would also like to thank our presenting sponsors, The Beguiling, Little Island Comics, and the Toronto Public Library. Thanks to our media sponsor, Now Magazine. We also recognize the support of the Canada Council for the Arts, and the Ontario Arts Council, and Toronto Arts Council. I love doing that because every year it gets just a little longer because we get more support. Hello, my name is Erica Friedman. I write about lesbian comics on my blog, Okazu. Today we welcome artist Emily Carroll to talk about her work and her newest book out from Koyama Press, When I Arrived at the Castle. Emily Carroll is a writer and artist of numerous award-winning comics, including her debut... Did you hear that? She said, this is true.
I didn't make this up.
No, she didn't. And if you did, would you have checked? Her debut horror comic, Through the Woods, which won both Anne Eisner and the British Fantasy Award in 2014. Her online comics works include numerous short stories with subject matter ranging from haunted rivers to ravenous hand lotions. Just saying. Her most recent work is a graphic novel adaptation of Laurie Halse Anderson's 1999 novel Speak, and the new book When I Arrived at the Castle, a vampiric lesbian hate story from Koyama Press. She lives in Stratford, Ontario with two dogs, one cat, and her wonderful, talented wife, Kate. So, welcome. And
yes,
welcome,
thank
Emily.
You. I also want to point out that Erica put together the 100 Years of Yuri display that's in front of page and panel.
Yes.
In the reference library, which is also amazing. You should also check that out.
Yes, you should, actually. But this isn't about me, so I wasn't going to say that. All those books are from my personal collection. Some of them never left the country, except for them when they left Japan the first time. So I sent Emily questions, and she approved. But
I've completely forgotten what they are at this
exactly.
point.
Exactly. So what I'd like you to do is come up with real good, intelligent, funny questions. Remember, it's okay to be rude if you're funny. That's my rule. It's not normal people's rules. That is my rule. And I think I'm only okay with it. Will you be okay?
Yeah, sure. Whatever. Let's get crazy.
All right. So let's get started. I've got stuff scrolling around. I hope you'll enjoy the pictures. I just randomly
yes, it's cool. Some. There's like a lot of stuff that like, I completely forgot. That like I forgot I did that.
I love that one.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah,
I've just been looking.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just went through your book and I went through your. The book is amazing. How many people have read When I Arrived at the Castle? Okay, it's awesome. Okay, so horror is undergoing a pretty major renaissance now. We see black horror in films and in comics. Like everywhere, and it's really comics and books are really pushing some envelopes with titles like Get Out and Box of Bones, which you can get at the Rosarium publishing table. Let's talk about queer horror. We don't see much of it yet.
I was thinking about this question earlier because there's, you know, specifically about the question of like black horror. Book has come out, everyone always asks me about horror, and it's like, they're always like, this big renaissance in horror, and I just want to say, it's just, like, it's Get Out. Like,
right.
Get Out's the movie.
Right.
Like that, like, when people are like, oh, there's so much stuff going on, it's like, you know, I feel like I cannot overstate the importance of Get Out, and what a huge movie that was. like not just in horror, but just like culturally, and how I hope it like opens up the door for like more black horror.
Right. Because, but there's also stuff going on in comics, and it was going on independently.
Yes.
Get Out,
so yes.
Bag of Bones, and just bringing things like Octavia Butler's Kindred, which is not obviously horror in any meaningful way, but let's face it. It's kind of horror, too.
I think
too.
The first stuff sort of is horror. Yeah,
it is,
for sure.
Right? And a lot of the Afrofuturism stuff tends to lean on that. And there's just a lot of really cool shit going on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the thing, that it's everything's always going on, right?
Right.
It's just, like, getting, like, money and eyes on it and all that kind of stuff. I know that a while ago I was reading a book of, like, you know, like, women horror writers or something from the 20th century. And it was all these women that I had never heard of, writing pretty scary stories, and it's like, I can't find them, these stories anywhere else. They're just collected in this thing, and these are, like, middle-class white ladies. Like, they're the ones who are going to get through. And so I was like, well, what other things am I not finding? So I tried to look up, black sci-fi authors and horror writers from the early 20th century, and it's just, like, it's so hard to find all this stuff. You know, things just get lost generationally.
Also, in the mid-20th century, a lot of stuff collected in pulp novel collections.
Yeah, yeah.
But they were not cataloged. Like, that wasn't serious stuff. It wasn't real literature.
Mm-hmm.
I have some old lesbian pulp stuff. And some of that could get really close to horror. You know, I have a lot of dead lesbians on my shelves. And you do find, like, it, you know, some of the tropes get a little fantastic after a while. Maybe it's just repetition.
Mm-hmm.
But none of that was real literature.
No, no.
So it's not anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, it was
yeah.
on Junkie. It was Penny Dreadfuls.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, like, I'll suggest, recommend right off the bat two things. I watched a documentary on Shudder. Do people know Shudder, the horror streaming service? There's a documentary that came out a couple months ago called Horror Noir, based on an academic work about the history, black history and horror, and black history as horror. I think, Tannen Areev Dhu is one of the producers on it, and also can't recall her name. She runs Graveyard Shift Sisters, which is a great horror website. And also the book How to Suppress Women's Writing by Joanna Russ, which is from 1983, I think. She was, of course, a sci-fi writer in the 70s. And that book, I think sometimes I see like the cover of it going around as a meme. Like it says, how you suppress women's writing.
Right.
And, but you could slot in women for any marginalized.
Of
like.
Course.
And that book, ironically, when I first ordered it, was out of print. but that's a great book. And it's also, like, funny, talking about how, things get, you know, get marginalized and made invisible because they're not categorized as horror or as this, because horror looks a certain way or sci-fi looks a certain way, and or they're writing about, you know.
I'm going to borrow my phone back for a moment. There was a movie we were just talking about on Twitter last night. It was a movie about three generations of black women who have superpowers, and it got amazing. It's something Colors, and I'm sorry, I have no short-term memory anymore, so I outsource everything to the internet. But it was did really well, got amazing critical acclaim, and nobody paid any attention to it whatsoever. And Fast Color, it's three generations of black women who have superpowers, and it was completely marginalized by its own marketing team, who gave it absolutely no theatrical space. It's showing in one theater in New York City.
Yeah.
One theater for 1 week in New York City. I mean, it's like, look, we put it out. You know.
But yeah, that's the thing. Like, even reading How to Suppress Women's Writing, I was like, this is because she wrote it because she saw this happening to the women sci-fi writers in the 70s. And it happened.
Right.
Like, basically, it's like these I think of it as like a chain, and links get broken,
right.
And so you feel isolated, and you can't reach back, so, like, but even as I have a running joke with, like, some cartoonist friends of mine, whether they're gay or women or whatever, we'll say, like, we'll be worrying about some comic or, like, something we're writing, and then, one of us will say, like, oh, who cares? Like, nobody will give a shit about this in 25 years. This will be buried under the sands of time. What am I talking about, worried about what people are going to think of this? But yeah, you can, like, see it happening.
And the other thing is, I was talking about with one of the Japanese artists here is a Yuri artist, and she was saying the labels are so limiting. I was like, the labels are the only way we can find things.
Mm.
So they're both incredibly important, really, really, really critical to find things that you want to read. Horror by women. But then it's horror by women. How do we find a place where we can surface things and also not limit them. And I'm not sure there's a way to make marketers, because marketers are the most aggressive thinkers in the world, speaking as a former marketing person. There's no way really to make it both findable, surfaceable, and also not limited at the same time, because labels, that's their actual permanent function.
Yeah.
They make it findable, but they also limit it all the time.
And so basically when you sent me this question, I did remember this question. The others, I'm in like a fugue state because of TCAF.
But
queer comics or queer horror, I am woefully undereducated on this subject. I was thinking about, and I just ingest horror all the time, but like usually it's just like,
there's a phrase.
Like what?
I ingest horror all the time.
Yeah, well, I was about to say like that you should, there's a phrase for that. It's like called just being like a horror trash can. And so I watch stuff all the time.
Horror.
And I was raised watching horror with my older brother and my dad, but cult films and stuff. But so like a lot of the horror I ingest and that were very formative for me are like just sort of like, I call it like bro horror. And I love it. Like I love all sorts of garbage.
We all do. I think ultimately at the bottom of every talented person is a love of absolute trash.
Yeah, and there's so much trash.
It's so much trash. And martial arts
and
trash.
It's easy to just like go around, like I could spend all day just like eating up all the trash, but like I have to actually make an effort to find like good
Something
things.
Good stuff.
This is actually a through line of my life.
Trash is what inspires us. I mean, it's cool to stand in front of an amazing fine arts painting and be really, really blown away, but you're not going, I'm going to be the next, you know, name some famous painter. You go, holy shit, this is the most shittiest movie I've ever seen. I totally want to make one of those. Like the martial arts movie we made in high school where somebody walks into a bar in Alaska and says, you killed my sled dog, I will fight you, you know. I mean, that's what inspires people.
Sure. Yeah. Or you see something that sucks, which you do all the time, and you're like, that would be great if I made it, like, better. If I took out the part that's
nobody's ever said that.
Yeah.
Nobody has ever said I could write it better.
What? Really?
Right? We've all said that a thousand times. It's the thing that makes everybody. But what do we think about, why is there no queer horror renaissance yet?
I mean, I think it's happening, it's just like there's not like, that's the thing. Like I think in every generation it's happening and then I guess that link gets broken. Right? So like, even now I'm just reconnecting now with like, you know, like gay writing from like the 80s or 90s that like I just hadn't gotten to, like I just like it really doesn't need to be right in front of me, it's bad. I admit that I do not seek it out as much as I should, even though horror itself in general, like I feel like there's a lot of pretty gay queer stuff.
There is a lot of queer stuff, even in some of the straight stuff is fairly queer.
Oh, that's like where it's like the most,
the 70s stuff.
that was basically when
I got out of sci-fi the first time. You know, it was sort of queer and sort of horror, but wasn't even owning any of that. And it was kind of like, it was all straight white men going, look how clever I am. And I went, all right.
Yeah.
I was 13 years old and I said, I am so done with sci-fi for like 30 years. And I was actually fairly accurate because it was like 33 years.
Well, it's like even I went back and read like some classic horror in the past like year. Like I read Dracula and I read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
That's fairly queer.
Oh, Dracula's like, it's all these guys being like really afraid of anything sexual.
Yeah.
And then like, you know, it's fun. But like, it's like these three guys.
So recently, not too long ago, a couple of years ago, I finally read Carmilla.
Oh yeah, sure.
I read the original, who is nuts, and I mean that in a kind way and not a demeaning way, but he's really nuts, and it's really queer. And the funny part is the punchline is, I have a word for you. You are vampire, and I thought wrong word. It should have been you are lesbian because the vampire stuff was super obvious, and so was the.
I thought the lesbian stuff was more obvious in Carmilla than I thought it was going to be.
I thought it was pretty.
Yeah.
Surface.
Yeah.
It was pretty surface.
It's right there.
It was right there.
Yeah.
Like, why are you in my bed? It was weird. But I feel like, yes, all marginalized communities live in dystopia all the time. So maybe that's kind of why. It takes a little extra freedom to go, we can make it, like, we can express our level of constant fear in a unique way, because we always have that constant fear.
Yeah, and I think, well, that's the thing, too, with my horror, aside from this book, because it's very personal to me, the new When I Arrived at the Castle, in a lot of my horror stuff, I don't make the characters... The characters are all straight.
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel really bad. putting gay people through bad stuff. Or not even just bad stuff, but making them bad people.
Okay.
Like, I feel like I don't want to, like, add to that. So, like, what if I just, like, torture these straight people for and they're awful and they're in denial or whatever. But, like, this book is different.
Yeah.
Because I'm torturing myself mostly through
it. Okay, all right.
And that's excusable. But, like, so a lot of the horror I respond to in movies and stuff, if the characters in it were gay, I might not like it as much. Like, I might not want to see them being brutalized as much as I want to see, you know, like how every horror movie begins with, like, there's, like, this, like, good-looking, like, this is the beginning of every horror movie. It's a good-looking, like, straight white couple who are, like, moving boxes into a new house, and their kids are like, ah, pick out your rooms, kids, and they're like, ah, I'm, like, running through, and then the wife's like, oh, and the husband's like, look, I know it was a big purchase, but, like, I think this is going to be a new start for us. Like, I think it's going to be great.
But isn't that exactly what they were making fun of in Beetlejuice, right? That was
the whole point of that.
And the thing is, you're watching it, you're going, yes, these are all the tropes, but he doesn't do it tropally. It's like, it's just, this is what it is, right? Yeah. This is what it is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think
I love that, because I'm always like, fuck these people.
Yes. But I think that's a lot of what's going on in Get Out, too. It's like, it starts with all of that stuff established, and you had to have known that was the scene that was like, 30 years ago, right? And then this is what happened.
And the great thing about Get Out, too, which Jordan Peele is interviewed in Horror Noir, and he's talking about how he's like, I made this movie, like, it's for black people. Mm-hmm. And, white people obviously enjoy it, but he's like, but he used the trope of, like, things like, he was like, played with the expectation that there's always one good white person. And he's like, there's not. In this movie. And, like, so, but, yeah, so, a lot of the horror that I really get, enjoy, like, it's one of those questions where people are, like, always saying, like, oh, why do we like horror? Like, do we like being scared? And it's like, no.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
But we also work out stuff.
It's really important.
I mean, the function of fiction, 95% of the time, is working out shit that you've got in your head, right? You're like, all right, I really just had this thing happen. And whether it was a life trauma or just fuck these people, is most of my fiction is fuck those people.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
You know, and that's really something to be said. Or I do a lot of lesbian pulp fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm like, why don't we have more lesbian pulp fiction? It's so charming, you know? I wrote a story once that was in one of my anthologies, and it's like, it's all the tropes, but all the people doing the art and all the publishing, they were young and they didn't understand the tropes, so it's a character comes to the big city from the farm, gets taken up by an older woman, and groomed, and they get into a knife fight, she ends up in jail, and I laughed my ass off writing this short comic, and nobody who read it ever understood it. I need somebody over the age of 50 to read it.
Yeah, that's the thing.
You know?
Yeah.
But you do, you work out all that stuff,
right? Yeah.
So what was the first horror comic?
As a kid, I read, like...
My first horror comic.
That was the title of it, yeah. I read, like, Tales from the Crypt, like old ones from, like, the 60s and 70s. Like the... Or whatever.
Weren't they all the same?
They were always... It's always, like, a thief who's got a big score, nothing's gonna go wrong, and then he's cursed or something. Or he's, like, caught in, like, a weird web of whoever he was robbing.
Or a terrible boss who is really abusive, and then gets, you know, locked in the wall safe that he was so excited about putting in. Like, it's always the
same.
Or
cheaters.
Tons of cheaters.
There's a lot of, like, a couple years ago, too, I got, like, at the library, like, one of those big collections of one of those books, and they're very, like, moralistic. Like, and any time a woman shows up, she's either going to be murdered, or she might be literally a monster.
Right.
Or like a jaguar. You know, like, it's like, always. She's always a monster. She's always this. It's always a thief. It's always comeuppance.
My favorite story ever was a cheater who kills his wife, and basically, while he's having his affair, she just keeps haunting him.
Yeah.
She's literally walking through the wall as he's having his affairs. And I was thinking, somebody was so angry.
Yeah.
So angry. There's a lot of anger in horror.
Oh, yeah. I think if it's good,
right.
Yeah. That's the thing that kind of, like, but those stories, I found them sort of bloodless, because it was like, so don't steal people's bejeweled arms or whatever you're stealing.
Don't break into Indian temples. You can't pronounce the names of them.
Yeah. It's like, so what kind of was more horrifying to me was growing up. Like I say, my dad and my brother were big, big horror fans. Like, they made, like, their own like horror, like my brother's 4 years older than me. They made their like own horror movies and stuff, which I was too shy to star in. But so they got me watching a lot of stuff, and my dad also was really big into urban legends. And, nice. And like the sociology of them and stuff like that, which is basically scary stories told in the dark. He's a folklorist who like put together these urban legends and folklore, and so my dad, as like scary stories, would tell us urban legends.
Nice.
And kind of, he would remove the sexy parts because he didn't want me. All the murder, gore, that was fine. So like all growing up, I was really into spoken word, like scary stories, stuff like that, urban legends. And there were like kids' books that really scared me, like Through the Woods, a book I did a couple years ago. The final story is based visually on Goodnight Moon, that book, because like my mom read it to me all the time as a kid, and she found out when I released my book that I hated it, because it creeped me out so bad, because they're like, it's so bright, like the room's like bright. Red and green and yellow, and the people are rabbits and they own cats. Like, it's just like everything about it was like weird.
Have you ever read the analysis of the room? There's a fantastic web article about interior designer's analysis of the room.
And oh, really?
It's the funniest thing. You're never gonna be able to read it out because it's just, you'll laugh and laugh and laugh.
Oh, like, so that really scared me. And then the other book that scared the shit out of me when I was a kid, which has inspired kind of my drawing style later on, was we moved into a house that had a we were renting it for a year, and then the owners had like all the kids' books. And they, like, didn't own a TV, and they only owned, like, you know, like, the highfalutin books. So in the kid's bedroom, I was 7, and the kid who usually lived there was 7, and they had a copy of The Highwayman, the Alfred Noyes poem, but it was illustrated by this illustrator named Charles Keeping. And I was 7, I had no familiarity with The Highwayman, and it is the scariest fucking book in the world. The drawings are so scary. Look up Charles Keeping. He also did Beowulf, he did The Lady of Shalott, and he's done ghost story compilations, but The Highwayman is so terrifying, and it's also like a horrible story, like a woman like shoots herself to warn her lover, and there's like this like horrible like kind of like sexual violence component to it. And
appropriate for children.
Oh yeah, no, why not? Get educated, kids.
You know, it's like Watership Down. You know,
oh, that,
it's like
that movie also scared the shit out of me.
Victorian children's books are all about death. Every one of them. Yeah. There's literally not a single book about Victorian child's book. So you're reading this thing to the kid and you're like, that's not cool. It's like this really horrible element.
Or The Velveteen Rabbit was another one that scared me. Right? To the point where like it wasn't until I was like an adult. I was talking to my wife about it and saying, like, you know, at least in The Velveteen Rabbit, the rabbit at the end gets, like, transformed into a real rabbit. And she's like, Emily, he dies. There's no magic in it. He died. He's burned. And I was like, what? I have, like, shielded myself from the reality of
Great.
The Velveteen Rabbit.
Now I got to do a therapy session. Yeah. So we're talking. You're naturally moving through those. So, who are your artistic inspirations? So, I looked at your online, your website, and I saw a touch of gory. So, do I see a touch of gory, or do you wish he'd come back to life so you could kill him?
I don't know about that. I know. Not consciously.
Okay.
You know, and I'm aware that, you know, there are. I'm sure, unconsciously, I probably did pick up some stuff because, you know, I do like his comics and.
And who are your inspirations?
Well, Charles Keeping is incredible. And I have a fictional town where a bunch of my webcomics take place, and I've named it Keeping after Charles Keeping. Who else? I'm just looking at my art now.
Do you have any like fine artists that inspire you? Or
trash artists? Well, I remember like I was really into like everyone is when they're like 19. Was really into like pinup art and like, you know, just like sexy ladies as objects.
Well, wait a second. Teenage? Like, is that still?
Yeah. But like that's all I wanted to draw was just ladies pose. And I still do that. But so I kind of like that, and, you know, it's hard thinking of who my creative influences. A lot of times, it's like my friends now, like other cartoonists, like Eleanor Davis is amazing, or Sophia Foster Domino. I mean, not that I really draw like either of them either, but
no, but they inspire you.
Yeah, yeah, I can see them.
The difference
pushing
between
and changing,
inspiration
yeah.
and being like, you know, wanting to draw like. I think there's kind of no real.
Although the first comic I made, I was like, I'm just going to basically look at like a Johan Svarr book and then close it and then draw my comic. and like try and draw how I think he draws. And I didn't draw anything like him. But
what a great exercise.
But like it kind of like once you start drawing, I just I'm just going to copy somebody. But once you start drawing on your own without actually looking at the reference, it will morph and like other things will get added to the sludge pile of whatever the drawing is.
Right.
Or like, you know, I like how that person draws eyes, and so I'll go on like this. Yeah, I'm sure. Like, I'm completely blanking on artists that I like, but like Junji Ito, who's here. There's like this book kind of wasn't. A lot of things were inspired by how he draws.
Which is kind of fun. Must be fun for you to be able to, like, get to see him. Have you managed to see him?
No, I'm just kidding. I couldn't.
I know, I do that, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, everybody does that, right? You go, like, you know, here's your favorite artist, and I let her walk through the world, bleh. Bleh, bleh, bleh.
Yeah, or, like, easy. I'm just looking at pictures, and I'm like...
That's the header. That last one was the header of your website.
Yes,
and I showed it to my wife, who went, ew.
Yeah, that's from the...
Great...
That's sort of from the hand lotion story. That's the main character from the hand lotion story. And
you do a lot with skins.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. Like, in the new book, too, I really like drawing, like, I find it very soothing, and I always have, since I was a kid, drawing, like, kind of, like, gore and, like, not real gore, like fake, like, I remember doing a webcomic where somebody drowns, and I show his face, his body, after he's drowned, and I was like, what did drowned bodies look like? And I did a bad thing, and Googled that, and what I had been picturing how they look was not how they look. It looks sad, you know, it looks like a person who's died. And I was like, well, I can't just draw that. Like, you know, you want to draw, you can't just draw the reality of the horrible thing. You have to think, also play into what people expect to see.
Right. The drama of the horrible
yeah.
thing. Yeah,
so I really grossed him up when I, you know, showed his face and stuff. But it was more like how I thought he would look. And so I really like drawing, like, horror and flesh coming apart and things like that. Because I have looked up tons of gore reference and stuff like this. And sometimes you see some stuff that are, like, that's inspiring. But for me, it's like looking up, like organic shapes, like even like weird mushrooms and stuff like that, and then like putting that in like a body element, like that's unpleasant, but
yeah.
It's very pleasant to draw. Like I can just sort of like bliss out and draw like little gore things like forever. So yeah, so that picture, yeah, it was very therapeutic.
It's sort of transformation. Also, it's not necessarily positive transformation. It's not, you know, we're not shedding our skin and becoming a butterfly. It's sort of the opposite.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something really horrific inside breaking
yes,
out.
Yes, well, that's
seen.
Like specifically, but like that comic is sort of about that. It's about a woman who's it was actually based on a real life horror experience I had where a neighbor invited me over for I thought like wine and drinks and something, and it was an Arbonne beauty party. When I first moved into the neighborhood, like we walked in and we're like, oh, we brought stuff, and she was like, okay, and then we turn and we just see like this table full of like products and like a little sign up sheet, and I was like, shit.
It was a really creepy story. I mean, I really woke up in the middle of the night on that one.
Like,
all right, that's pretty horrible.
Like, yeah, that one. So that was also like, and also it's just like it's working stuff out, and it's anger. It's like I have all this stuff to do, like anybody does, about my body and my perception of it, and how I have to live in it, and how the reality of it doesn't match. You know what
right,
you
of
see,
course. Yep.
And like you also don't know what other people see, like. So that's what that book
and living with
really
the about. Internality of it, because that's what I felt a lot about. Like there's so much stuff. Like I've got this body and the stuff going on and it is visible, but there's so much of that going on.
Yeah,
and you know, so things are coming out and things are going in, and I don't really have any control.
And
over
it's
that.
And you feel shameful about
shameful.
These processes.
There's a lot of shame in when I arrived at the castle. It's like playing with
that. Yes, for sure. There is a lot of shame.
So let's talk about that. The horror of the feeling of shame, because that can go on. I could linger in a way that scary doesn't.
Well, that's hopefully what a lot of, like, the horror... I was talking to somebody after my panel the other day, because they were like, I want to do creepy comics or something like this.
Yeah.
What advice do you have? And they asked their question, and I answered in, like, you know, 10 seconds on the panel, and afterwards I was like, hey! Like, let me talk to you more.
Let me pick you up against the wall and talk to you. You have 3 hours?
But, like, what I try to do in my horror... And, again, a lot of people don't call my stuff horror, because it's, like... Whatever. Put it in a different box or whatever.
Right.
So, people are like, it doesn't scare me at all. It's like, well, then you're very interesting. But anyway.
Or not.
Yeah.
I guess it would be not scary if you lack imagination.
Yeah.
Isn't that sort of part of, like, your comics particularly, the reader needs to have the imagination to understand the implications and the next steps and the, oh, where did it go from there? And there's a lot of stuff going on that you kind of have to make it happen.
People take whatever meaning they want from it. But, like, you know, I always try and start with an unresolvable feeling and then build off from there. I think of it as like a spine is the core feeling. So, like, shame or... You distill it down to whatever the you know, most concentrated form is, like helplessness or fear or whatever of helplessness, blah, blah, weakness, your fear of your weakness. So you make that the spine, and the rest of the story is, like, putting, like, the muscles over the spine and then putting the... Like ribs.
Awesome.
Coming around.
That's awesome.
That's why I'm like making this. I'm like, you know, when you make a story and it's like. that's. And, because what I said to this person yesterday was, you know, a lot of horror, you watch a movie and it's like a werewolf movie. And I use this example all the time, but like, if a werewolf walked in this room right now, we'd all be very alarmed and scared because a werewolf could kill us. But if I'm watching a movie or I read a story, it's like, and then a werewolf walked in, I'd be like, then fucking shoot it. You know, like, problem solved. Like, you never want, like, a resolvable problem. And so if it's, like, a thing like shame, or, like, if you build off that, and even if you create a creature that's, because I've done a werewolf story, if you create that as, like, emblematic of, like, some deeper thing, then you can't solve, like... You know, your deep-rooted issues.
Right, you start with something unresolvable, but at the end of it, it's still unresolvable.
Because that was always the part of a horror movie or a story that I hated, was you get to a certain... I remember specifically on the movie, with the movie Phantoms, based on the Dean Koontz novel with Ben Affleck, came on the 90s. I was so scared. I saw it was like 12 or something. I was so scared of that movie for so long, because it's so mysterious, like, what's happening in this abandoned... It's basically like Silent Hill. And then at a certain point, they're like, oh, yeah, it's like an evil entity that's like a monster or something. And I was like, oh, shoot it. Like, it's like done. And I felt so, like, mad at the story that they took away this feeling I had been having.
Right.
Once they're like, what we got to do is, even if what you have to do is, like, impossible, so long as it's like, oh, we've got to go to the ancient temple and, like, ring a bell 5 times and then, like, sacrifice a child. It's like, well, then do that. I don't know. I have no stakes in this. I usually try to make things, like, unresolved and just kind of feel my way through it. Because, like, yeah, a lot of my comics are pretty therapeutic for me.
So let's talk a little bit specifically about off of that When I Run Through the Castle. So what are some of, we've gone through a lot of the motivations and inspirations you have, but why don't you tell us a little bit in excruciating detail about the process you have for actually drawing?
Yeah. Okay. And I also see you wrote down Shirley Jackson.
I did. When I saw the title, When I Arrived at the Castle, I immediately went straight to We've Always Lived at the Castle, which I hate with a visceral passion, so...
You hate that?
No, and I hate it for reasons that doesn't make any sense. My sister-in-law, it was like the main character is exactly like my sister-in-law, and it really creeped me out. So, I've been friends with her since I was 12 years old, and I know her really, really well, and as I'm reading them, I'm like, this could be her. And I couldn't get past it. Like, literally spent the entire time imagining it her, and it was just impossible for me to read this story with any level of comfort.
But I wanted to say Shirley Jackson's big. When you talk about inspirations, I can pick up more like a literary or whatever. Shirley Jackson is a huge. I love. She's incredible. That one.
The question actually says, "Was that a thing in my head, or is it?" Oh. Yeah. No, that was not a thing in my head.
No, but it wasn't a thing in my head either. I just probably was like, "Oh, I like that book."
Sounds like right.
Yeah,
sounds good. Sounds good.
And like,
and that's what you do. That is how inspiration works.
Yeah, Haunting of Hill House, also a great book. Has a bisexual character as a human, you know, or lesbian. It's hard to whatever. It's not like Carmilla. You have to actually.
Carmilla really is really.
And The Sundial is another book by her, which is really creepy and scary. And then I also started reading her a biography of her and hearing about this total fucking asshole she was married to. That's the real horror story. Yep. But
isn't that always the way?
Yeah. So, yeah, this book was never, like, meant to be an actual, like, book. I never thought I would actually publish this. It happened because I had just finished drawing Speak, which is based on a Laurie House Anderson novel that she wrote about a sexual assault, a 13-year-old girl at the beginning of high school experiencing sexual assault and going into depression and all this stuff. And it's, like, a heavy book to read, to draw it, especially, like, I think I drew it in, like, 9 months or something, but when I say that, like, it's 400 pages or something, and I drew, like, the most of it in the last, you know,
wow.
4 months before it was due, you know? And so
it's good to know you take things seriously.
Yeah. So that was really heavy to be in that headspace of this character for, like, the longest time. And I didn't think I was bothered by it, but I think I was, because, you know, it brought up a lot of stuff from when I was that age, and so I was really burnt out after that book ended. And, finally, I was like, I should get back to drawing comics. What I'll do is I'll just start drawing a page of, like, whatever I want to draw. And then, like, maybe I'll do, like, a 5-page comic. And I'll make up each page as I go. So I think the third page of When I Arrived at the Castle is the first page I drew. It's, like, where you introduce, like, the vampire characters, like, just out of the bath. And she's looking down. And I was like, yeah, I'll draw, like, a sexy vampire lady. And then I was like, when's it my time to draw a sexy vampire? And then I'll draw, like, another character coming in, and I'll make her, like, in this, like, doll-like costume. And then I thought, like, oh, but what's she supposed to look like? Like, I don't want it just to be, like, two hot ladies. But then I don't want it to be, like, a hot lady and, like, a frumpy lady. And then I have trouble drawing human faces because I have this thing where, like, I look at what I've drawn and I'm like, how is anyone going to be scared or take this seriously? This is a cartoon. This is a cartoon drawing. So, like, I feel like my skills aren't like that. So I was like, I'll make her cat lady. I like drawing kitty cat faces or whatever.
And cute people like cats.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, whatever. And who cares? Like, I'm just doing this
and
for
fun. And there's a great metaphor there, you know? Whatever.
Yeah, yeah, so. Whatever. So so I started drawing that. And then as I went, I, like, got really into it to the point where I was like, this is my job now is drawing this comic. But I made it up as I went along.
Okay.
So I had no concept of, like, what the story was or whatever. I vaguely had an idea that I wanted there to be, like, a bloodbath, like, sexual climax sequence. But that was it. I was like, that happens later on. So I made it up as I went along. And as I went along, you know, I realized at a certain point that this book was, like, clearly me working out some personal demons. And once I realized that's what it was about, I was like, well, fuck this. And I was like, I'm not going to do this anymore. Right. And so I was like, how trite. Like, you know, like.
But
so,
you still got to work at it.
Yeah. I was like, no, I'm fine. What are you talking about?
I don't need
this. I'm better than this. So I shelved it for like a month or two. And then things got really bleak again. And I thought, I've got to go back to, like, just to, like, honestly, like, get up in mm-hmm. the morning. I got to go back to this. And then so I went back to it. I kind of addressed my issues, and then I completed the book. And at that point, I was like, maybe I could actually publish this. Like, maybe somebody wants it. And then I was like, maybe Annie wants it. Because, like, I haven't worked with Koyama before, and I've always really wanted to.
And Annie's awesome.
Yeah, and like, I can't believe I got in, like, under the wire of them having their final year.
Right.
Like, I remember her calling me after I had emailed her and sent her the book, and I was like, do you guys want this? Because I also wanted it to be, like, big. Like, I'm really happy with how it's, like, the size of the book. And she called me, and she, like, talked to me for, like, 25 minutes in this very apologetic tone without telling me quite why she was apologetic yet. And I was like, she's going to say no to the book. And I was like, okay, she doesn't want it. It's fine. But, like, it was just like, it's the last year. Are you sure you still want it published by us?
And yeah.
I was like, yes.
Yes.
What?
Yeah,
what are you
yeah.
doing to me? So, yeah, so this book is interesting in that I, like, it came, like, very intuitively. And then, yeah, like, I just drew the characters right. constantly outside of the book.
I love this picture so much.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm going through your website going, I want to print to that one.
Yeah. So, like, that.
This was great. This is where I felt the gory.
Oh, sure,
of,
yeah.
This is
yeah,
very, very gory inspired.
Yeah. But, like, yeah, so, like, that, so that it was, like, this very intuitive, almost experimental book. That's why it's, like, not linear, not narrative. I knew it wouldn't be everybody's thing. But the people that it was for would really like it.
I think it's fantastic.
Thank you.
I really was so blown away by it.
And like, it made me, I got really into the characters so that, yeah, like, I did, like, a little art book of them. And then I drew the cat character. I started sculpt. I have all these cat sculptures of that cat from the book. I've got, like, 13 of them on my desk. And like, I started, like, really, like, feeling like that cat character is, like, my avatar within my comics world. So, like, to the point where this, like, I have this, like, meta of the cat. There's the book that just went past, the Beneath the Dead Oak Tree by Shortbox. That was published by Shortbox, which is for sale also at TKF. I thought, like, the cat from this book that I'm doing directed that comic. Like, she's on set all the time. Like, she came up with all these costumes. She's truly incredible. Like, and, like, she's dating the main fox. Like, they were seen together. So, like, I, like, drew these pictures that were, like, paparazzi photos. And I was like, because they're actors. And then somebody asked me, like, oh, well, what happened to her and the vampire? Like, did they break up? And I was like, oh, she's like a demon from hell. Like, she was bad news and whatever. And that's all three of them there, hanging out, after party, I
another
guess.
Another great friend.
Yeah.
Another great friend. We've talked a lot about this. You talked about Speak, but I do want to say congrats on the Eisner.
Thank you.
Really, really amazing. So I have one more question, really. How tempted are you to downplay your own work and give other people credit when people say, wow, congrats on the Eisner?
Well, the Eisner stuff, it's different because I have two already. No. That's different. With the Eisner stuff, I actually did go to the Eisners 1 year, and that is a long ceremony. But that aside, one thing I noticed when I was there is that, you know, people would get nominated for whatever their win. And men would go up, and they would be, like, you know, in tears, like, I've always wanted this. Like, this means so much to me. What, like, a pinnacle of my career. And then women would go up, and they'd be like, oh, thank you. This is wonderful. And I was like, it's because I never even... This was never even on my radar. Like, it was never, like, a big life goal of mine to win an Eisner or be nominated for an Eisner. I didn't even know that was a thing until I was, like, 5 years into comics. Like, I was so excluded from that club that it didn't even occur to me to want that thing.
Okay.
So, like, the Eisner thing is very cool, but I also do like being shitty about it. Like, I think one of my, like, you know, weird lady horror comics, web comics, like, won over, like, for best short story over Batman and Superman.
Nice.
And I was like, yeah.
They could be totally...
Whoever they are.
I have a friend who's a translator, and I said, you know, he said something about having won an Eisner. And I said, you know, I've never won an Eisner. He says, yeah, you should do that sometime. Thanks, Zach.
Well, I want to win. I want to win this. I mean, I would like to win for Speak, but also, because Laurie Halse Anderson, who wrote the original novel and wrote the graphic novel, is incredible. And that book has, like, changed people's lives. Going to signings and things with Laurie is absolutely amazing. She's so good at being an author in a public space. And... But I also got nominated for Beneath the Dead Oak Tree, which I made for Zainab Akhtar of Shortbox, and I really want to win that one for her. Like, and because that comic was me being really mad about some stuff,
nice.
And it's nice to see that, I don't know, like, I don't think I'm going to go, and I don't think I would make somebody read out my...
Totally.
Diatribe.
Do the video thing. Hi, I can't be there because I hate you all.
But
damn,
I could write a good
one. This to me.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Just saying.
Yeah. Yeah, so like that I'm kind of excited
That's
about.
That's really cool.
But I do, like, I don't know. It's hard. I really struggled with, you know, like, the imposter syndrome stuff. To the point where, like, imposter syndrome, like, really caught fire as, like, a thing people have. And I was like, all these people. Like, I feel like an imposter saying I have imposter syndrome.
Okay.
I feel like it's kind of cocky to say you have imposter syndrome because that's you're admitting that you're actually good.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That's where I was. I'm not so much there anymore. But, like, I really did have that. And because when my comics became popular, it was, like, on the internet and it was really fast.
Right.
And so the immediacy of the success was there, but the immediacy of people telling me that, like, I suck was there, and that made me like, you know, you can get like 1,000 comments of people saying you're really great, but then that one comment of someone being like, eh, you're okay. You're like, that person knows. Like, they saw, they get it. They saw through it. They're telling it like it is. And
I always say I outsource all my self-criticism to the internet. Like I have very flat, my self-esteem is very healthy. Yeah. I don't have to worry about it. Like people say, you know, don't you worry about yourself and everything. I'm like, no, the internet tells me everything that's wrong with me and I don't really have to think about it at all.
Yeah. Yeah. So like, but like, I mean, I mostly like it's been like great. It, like, I mean, if you, like, I remember I actually blocked Reddit from my computer for like 5 years after my first comic came out. Cause I made the mistake of going to like a thread that was about his face all red, the first comic that I did that really was popular. It's still probably the most popular one. And the thread was like 300 comments long of people saying like, oh, this must be about that and this must be about that, or like, this, the lilacs mean this, and you know, this means that, and it's clearly a Jesus allegory. And I was like, fuck, was I supposed to come up with reasons for everything? Like, and I felt like if I didn't have the reason for whatever I put in the comic, then I was a fraud. Because a real smart person, all my fears come down to me thinking I'm stupid. If a real smart person would have that all laid out and that all planned out. So like when people did ask me like, what do the lilacs mean? I was like, I actually Googled, what do lilacs symbolize? Like I would like have gotten some cosmic knowledge from this website before I made it. And I was like, well, they could be unrequited love. And literally why I did put lilacs in was because I grew up with a lilac bush outside my house, and I remember the smell. Sure. And I needed a flower smell. Like, it could have been any flower smell, but I was just familiar with that one. Yeah. So, like, yeah, I've gotten better with it now, but it's really hard to trust. I think it's not so much giving other people credit, because I am very controlling and, like, working by myself a lot of the time. Yeah. But, like, it's more just believing that other people, having respect enough for other people to know that they're telling you the truth when they say, like, I like this or this means a lot to me, as opposed to me just being like, you're just saying that to be nice. Like, anyone, like, yeah.
And the closest friends, whatever, that, when have they ever been nice? Why would they start now?
Yeah. So, like, yeah, so I think that's what it is for me, is kind of trusting in that, and that it's like, you know, that I'm not going to, like, every time I put in a new comic, I say to my wife, like, this one's a weird one, no one's going to like it. And she's like, you always say they're going to be weird, and they're never, like, frankly, they're not that weird. And I'm like, oh, jeez. Fine. So
you are an imposter after all, you just can't do it. Is there a question that you always want to answer that nobody asks you?
Oh my god, I wish I'd remembered that.
Okay. In the meantime, we have just time for just a few questions. Do we have any questions for the audience, or she'll think about this? Yes.
So I'm curious about Speak and why you decided to do a collaborative comic.
Well, Speak, I actually I got the offer and signed in 2013 for Speak and didn't come out until this past year. So it was early enough in my career that I was like, yeah, like I want to work on like a huge, you know, this big thing. And I didn't feel confident doing a big, like writing and drawing a big graphic novel at that time. So, you know, in the time that it took for, because then Lori went and wrote it for like 4 years or whatever, and then I had to do revisions and blah, blah, blah. So probably if I had been offered that later on in my career, I would have said no. Like now I don't do any, I'm only going to work on my own written stuff and my own drawn stuff. But back then I was like, yeah, sure, that seems like it. And I honestly am very glad I did it, because Lori is amazing and the work she does is amazing. And it's like really, like it's being taught in a lot of like schools and stuff like that. Which is really neat, but yeah, I think it was just like I came at like exactly the right time. Also, Lori, when I was offered the book, she asked to send. She was like, "Have you heard of this book?" And I was like, "No." She offered to send me a copy, and the copy that she sent also came with a handwritten letter from Lori, saying why she specifically wanted me to draw this book. And that was, like, more respectful than, like, any writer has ever been to me. So that went a long way, too, I think, that extra touch. Like, you could tell she really cared.
Cool. Thank you. We probably have time for, I guess, maybe one more. Yeah, we have a couple more, so let's get a couple more.
I really liked the Yogg.
Oh,
I was wondering, like, on your websites and with webcomics, there's a lot of, like, especially in the later ones, like, the layout and paneling and stuff is just so interesting. Have you thought any more about doing any more, like, visual novels or anything like that?
I would love, the Yogg is a game I did for Comics versus Games here at TCAP a few years ago, and then Damian Summer, who I made it with, he like polished it up and put it up for sale on Steam, just for people who don't know, and it's like a choose your own adventure kind of party game. That was made in like a month. Like I keep looking at the art like, oh, I wish I could. I mean, I won't, but my webcomics are greatly influenced by games. I play games all the time. And I think I would like to work more on them. My wife works in games. She made Gone Home and Tacoma. The only thing keeping me back from making games is I get very easily frustrated with like the stuff I see her doing. When I see her screen, like she makes like 3D art and objects, it's like all like math and then like a weird like graph or something. And then I'm like, what's that? She's like, a chair. So I can't like, that's, I don't know if I can access that area of the brain required. With visual novels, I would love to. And I've definitely thought about making more game-like web comics, but for me too, I really like to work like kind of quick and dirty on them and by myself. And I know that if I worked on a game, I'd have to actually ask for help from people. Just like, maybe I should do this. It's also like games are pretty lucrative. I would definitely like to do some stuff in the future for games. Thanks.
I think we had one back there.
You're a horror fan, what personally, like, what specific types of horror do you think really get you the most, like, really get you scared?
What's your moe?
Oh.
That was something Takashi was saying last night. She said, what's your moe? And I went, wow, that's really kind of brilliant.
I like, if there's a horror movie where it's people at a dinner party, I like that a lot. I like a closed environment dinner party, and you know something's gonna happen. This is like the horror I ingest, like which I know is not the greatest horror. I really like I like a high concept stuff, like when things get really kind of wild. I just watched Annihilation. I liked that a lot. And like when there's just like something normal, like a dinner party, but then there's something wrong. There's a weird vibe. It's hard on that case because you can't take it too far. But I also like knowing what happens with it. I don't like knowing like where the aliens came from or if they're aliens at all or you know that kind of thing. But that's usually what I go for. I also watch like found footage garbage. I'll watch that.
Okay. Yes, you have one.
On the topic of this work, like, needs to be archived, or, like, we need something to connect, like, marginalized works, but then the label is super limiting. I know in academia, like, the big LGBT genres are, like, lit fic or memoir autobiography, so something is, like, genre, like, LGBT sci-fi, LGBT horror, it's not, like, legitimate LGBT.
Right. Well, all genre
literature
is not legit, unless a man writes it, in which case he's a genius.
Yeah, so do you think
that's
that
just kind of
like
the way it is.
This kind of double marginalization, you're writing in the genre fiction, but you're also... Like,
romance, forget romance. Like, you know, I just think about Jane Austen. When I was a kid, nobody ever mentioned her. Now everyone's going, hey, she was a legitimate genius. But it took that many years. It took literally half a century. In American and British education, be like, wait, she's really, she got it. She was a literature.
Yeah, and I think there's also, like I know when I was, like, in my early 20s and stuff, because of my own, like, internalized homophobia or whatever, I'd be like, I don't want to be a gay horror writer. I just want to be a horror writer. And
do you want to go back?
That's what I sounded like. And so I think there's also that buzz, like, you know, and that's everyone's, you know,
I'm a
kind
horror
of
writer
to,
who's gay. It's
yeah,
different.
I just happen to be... and I mean, it's all fine, whatever. God bless everyone. I think for me, that's like, I remember like reading, like early on in my 20s, I got like a queer horror anthology. And I was like, these stories suck. And I was like, they're a bit too gay for me. And I know that was just like me being afraid or not being...
But they also could have sucked. I mean,
legit. They probably also did, but most horror stories, like, what? I don't ingest stuff that sucks? Like, I'm always reading and watching stuff that sucks. But, like, why won't I make that allowance for that kind of stuff. So that I've kind of, you know, gotten over because it's ridiculous. But, like, I can understand that being an impediment to people. But, you know, it's just hard because, you know, we get isolated and we don't want to reach out because we have internalized that fear of even ourselves and people like us. So.
Another question. Did I see one over here somewhere? I thought I saw someone over here. Anybody else? Okay. Well, I'll probably get somebody different areas.
If money / notoriety wasn't a problem, like, in the magical world, what would you most like to make comic-wise?
Can we add my skill level to that? I would really like to do, like I really want to do a Macbeth. I kind of played around with it, and then I really didn't like the results of once I did, like, a few pages. I was like, this is not what I want this to look like. So it's, like, not even money and notoriety. It's, like my dumb human hands. Like, if I could just, like, I just need to unlock something. I think that would be my main one that I would like to
do. That would be awesome.
Yeah, but I'd like to do, like, more, like movies and stuff, too. Oh, I'd love to write, like, an Evil Dead movie. That reboot of Evil Dead, not even reboot, that, like, whatever, remake, that came out a few years ago with the female, like, drug addict protagonist. I love that movie. That's, like, my, like, calm movie. If I want to watch it, just, like, the end, there's, like, this rain of blood. That's so cool. And I grew up watching the Evil Dead movies and was, like, obsessed with Evil Dead 2 especially. So I'd really like to write an Evil Dead movie.
And I think we've come to the end of our time, so I want to thank again.
Thank you.
I want to thank Tika for having us here. Please stop by Koyama Press on the first floor to pick up when I arrived at the castle. And
Shorefox on the second floor for this book.
Yeah, for Beneath the Beneath
the Dead Oak Tree.
And thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
And thank you very much. It was a pleasure to really be here. Thank you.
Thanks.